Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 399, titled The Serpent's Diaries, being recorded on February 16th of 2003. The title is a contraction for two Nazi tracts put out by the National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, Serpent's Walk and The Turner Diaries, hence the title. Bear in mind that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Longer programs available at a longer URL linked to both that address and to spitfirelist.com in the For the Record section. There'll be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of this broadcast in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week of the recording of the program. Now, in tying together a number of seemingly disparate elements toward the end of the first side, I read a section from one of the books whose title has been contracted to the title of this program, The Turner Diaries, and now I'm going to read from the other book, Serpent's Walk. Both books, by the way, are novels intended as teaching tools, and in both books, the Nazi underground, literally the Underground Reich, something which can be well documented from the proper sources, For the Record 305, by the way, For the Record 361, number 273 and 370, document this. But in Serpent's Walk, like in Turner Diaries, the Nazi takeover takes place after there is a widespread series of terrorist attacks using weapons of mass destruction, wiping out much of the American population, including people in large urban centers, particularly on the East and West coasts, martial law is declared, and the Nazi underground takes over. In Turner Diaries, we read an excerpt, and bear in mind that that's what follows the widespread, quote, order, unquote, attacks using nuclear weapons on September 8th. And in Serpent's Walk, it is biological weapons, specifically genetically engineered weapons, that wipe out much of the population. Bear in mind that the Turner Diaries, which may very well have been the inspiration for the attack on the Pentagon, certainly there is a strong similarity between the low-level aerial suicide attack on the Pentagon in Turner Diaries and the one that took place on September 11th, although it is not a precise correspondence. Discussing Larry Ford in For the Records 317 and 386, Larry Ford was a doctor with connections to the South African Biological Warfare Program and to the CIA. He also was in touch with right-wing extremists and militia elements in the United States and to an underground South African fascist organization called Die Organisatie. In a New York Times story that we looked at in For the Record 386, we looked at how we examined Larry Ford's statement to a girlfriend that if the girlfriend wanted to understand him, meaning Larry Ford, she should read the Turner Diaries. So the Turner Diaries apparently was to a certain extent the inspiration for Larry Ford. It was the inspiration for Timothy McVeigh and company in the Oklahoma City bombing, the inspiration for the Nazi terror group The Order in the 80s, and also quite possibly the inspiration for the Islamofascists who attacked the Pentagon on September 11th. And there are links such as Al-Taqwa between the Islamo-fascist and white supremacist movement. Again, common elements: desire to wipe out Israel, wipe out the Jews, and destroy the United States. And again, in terms of understanding operational links, the goal of the Nazi underground is to decimate the United States and then take over after a badly reduced United States goes out of control. Now, if they correspond this passage from Serpent's Walk with the passage from Turner Diaries with which I closed the first side. And again, here is the similarity in how one could see the Islamo-fascists and the white supremacists hooking up, which in fact they have. Again, the Turner Diaries is about the SS going underground, buying into the opinion-forming media, infiltrating the army, and then after martial law is declared, they take over the United States. And reading from the back cover, talking about the SS, a century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. Now, here is what happens in Serpent's Walk. Compare this with Turner Diaries. The news they had picked up in Seattle was bad. Many of the great eastern cities were dead or dying. Houston and Dallas had been infected with a ghastly, bacteria-borne, botulin-like poisoning. Similar outbreaks were now being reported in Cleveland and Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, Boston, Portland and Salt Lake City, Miami, and a dozen other places. The nation was being held together only by the most desperate measures imposed by frantic police, National Guard units, and the military. In Detroit, the FBI nabbed a man in the very act of emptying a vial of bacterial broth into a reservoir. The man swallowed the stuff and then leaped into the water anyway. Detroit was now off limits to anybody not wearing an NBC, nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare suit. The Army estimated nearly a million deaths in Detroit already. The toxin was delivered through the water supply, but it killed more than just those who drank it, and those who came into too close contact with the drinkers as they vomited and coughed their lives away. Wherever it collected, in holding tanks and sewers, it fumed and bubbled and emitted bacteria-laden mists. When a fire set off a sprinkler system in a discount store in Cleveland, 1,000 people died. It was the same all over. Russia's science had been almost as thorough as America's in the Megadeth department. By the way, in this book published in 91, the microorganisms were of Russian extraction. I would note that in For the Records 356, 357, and 359, we noted a biopreparat, a Russian and former Soviet biological warfare link to the Islamo-fascist Al-Taqwa milieu, which in turn has connections to the underground Reich. And not only to white supremacists, but radicalized African-American Muslims in the United States. Continuing with Serpent's Walk. New York, Chicago, and Washington were cemeteries. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, and certain other cities had so far escaped. Perhaps the enemy's distribution system had failed on the West Coast. Perhaps it was just slower, and death was still on its way, skipping down. Who was spreading the toxin? The carriers were entering the United States along the drug routes, Miami, the Gulf Coast, the Canadian border, and the deserts of the Southwest. Morgan, who served as the American representative for one of the movement's conglomerates, had heard that most of the people were a motley assortment, druggies with habits so heavy they would risk anything for a pop of smile dust, the usual dispossessed Palestinians and Iranians, criminals, psychopaths, and madmen whose hatred and greed outweighed their instinct for self-preservation, and mercs willing to escalate war beyond any usual civilized limit. And again, there are some strong similarities between the realities as portrayed in Serpent's Walk and the realities as portrayed in Turner Diaries. By the way, one of the things to note is that in both books, martial law is declared, and as presently constituted, the U.S. military simply does not have sufficient personnel and resources to conduct operations abroad and also to basically impose martial law in the United States. And even with proxy forces, say police and National Guard, that would be beyond keeping the entire United States, even a badly destroyed United States, would be beyond the material means of the military. In the martial law contingency plans that were developed under the Reagan administration and that were developed under the auspices of the counterterror program, the pre-crisis planning group chaired by the elder George Bush, for whom, by the way, CIA headquarters is named, the martial law contingency plans took that into account, and basically they provided for the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers as federal agents in order to help enforce martial law. And I suspect that in the martial law contingency plans, which we describe, by the way, in RFA number 32 that's available from Spitfire, in the martial law contingency plans, we may very well find the seed of what takes place in Serpent's Walk and in Turner Diaries. Because, again, the United States military does not have the resources to function abroad and to maintain order in the United States. And so that the martial law contingency plans developed under the auspices of George Bush's pre-crisis planning group and involving the intergovernmental agency networks that were in the command of the first George Bush, we may very well see the scenario that will be coming to pass in the event that, God forbid, something like Serpent's Walk or Turner Diaries or both takes place. What we're going to do next is to take a look at something which I think will in many ways provide the substantive link between the way that I see the manipulation of not only the situation in Israel and the Palestinian conflict, but also by the propagandizing that I'm seeing in the United States, particularly not just from the right wing, which has been doing this for a long time, but it's coming now out of the left. And we're even seeing this in the mainstream press to a certain extent as well. And that is basically this, and this takes place in Serpent's Walk and in the Turner Diaries, both of which portray the United States as basically in the grip of a Zionist conspiracy. And what we're going to look at first is an excerpt from a column, an op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, again, a mainstream source. This is from February 13th of 2002. This is an article by George Bisharat, and it's titled American Jihad. And basically what this article does is to posit the American saber-rattling against Iraq as, in effect, part of a Zionist conspiracy controlling the United States, which, of course, it does not. But I would note, the as we discussed in For the Record program number 397, that there are links between the right wing of the Zionist movement and the underground Reich, and we've talked about those at considerable length in For the Records 397 and 398, among other programs. But in terms of analyzing the motivation of the Bush administration in Iraq, I would suggest several levels of motivation. One, oil. Two, oil. Three, oil. And four, I would suggest that the Bush administration really does not have any sort of viable domestic policy other than turning the United States Christian, but that the this is keeping the war talk and the war maneuvering has kept basically everything else off the front burner. I would also note that there's a very strong element within the Republican Party that is of a fundamentalist Christian orientation that sees everything that's going on, from September 11th to the move toward war in the Middle East, in the context of Armageddon, a climactic battle in the Middle East in which those Jews who don't get converted to Christianity will be wiped off the face of the earth following the reestablishment of Israel, and then Jesus will come to earth after the tribulation, and everybody will live happily ever after, except, of course, for the Jews who have been wiped out. I would take a look at what is taking place in the Middle East, not just in terms of the maneuver of Islamic fanatics, but also Christian fanatics in the United States. That, however, is something that remains to be seen. But notice that in this article, which is in the mainstream press, the author, again a professor at Hastings Law College in San Francisco, is portraying the maneuvering by the Bush administration for war in Iraq as basically a function of Zionist control of George Bush. Why the determination to overthrow the Iraqi regime? One key is the special regard of the hawks for Israel's right-wing elements. A number of senior Bush officials, including Wolfowitz, Fife, and others, have strong affiliations with the Likud party of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, as documented by Bill and Kathleen Christensen in the online magazine Counterpunch. By the way, Counterpunch is published by, among others, co-published by Alexander Coburn, who in the past has taken monies from, among other institutions, Saddam Hussein, at least according to the book American House of Saud by Stephen Emerson. Coburn received some $10,000 during the 1980s for work on the Middle East. Continuing with the analysis here, or quote analysis, Fife and Defense Policy Board member Richard Perr, for example, helped author a 1996 study for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu describing Hussein's overthrow as, quote, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right and a means of foiling Syria's regional ambitions, unquote. Interestingly, the study for the Israeli government also advocated resort to preemptive strike, a theme now taken up by President Bush. If an Iraqi attack on the United States is far-fetched, a rejuvenated Iraq could eventually alter the regional balance of power now favorable to Israel. Iraq is the only Arab state to combine oil wealth, water, and a large population, more than 23 million, making it a potential powerhouse. War on Iraq would eliminate for the foreseeable future any obstacle to a disposition of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on terms that satisfy Israel's territorial ambitions on most or all of the West Bank. Israel is quietly exultant at the turn in U.S. policy, occasionally hinting that Iran or Syria should be next. Israeli Deputy Interior Minister Gideon Ezra suggested to the Christian Science Monitor in August that a U.S. attack on Iraq will help Israel impose a new order without Yasser Arafat in the Palestinian territories. Quote, "The more aggressive the attack is, the more it will help Israel against the Palestinians. The understanding would be that what is good to do in Iraq is also good for here," unquote. A U.S. strike would, quote, "undoubtedly deal a psychological blow," unquote, to the Palestinians, and would help Israel vis-a-vis Syria, Ezra added. Does this mean that we are going to war for Israel rather than the United States? That question is incomprehensible to the hawks, who view the two countries as two democracies shoulder to shoulder facing the common threat of terrorism. Like the Israelis, the hawks would not stop at Iraq. And again, this is actually a column that has appeared in a mainstream paper. One of the things to note, and we're going to take a look at the what I believe to be the geostrategic and geopolitical maneuvering behind this. One of the things to note is that Iraq recently, I think this was actually in 2001, but they are moving to price their oil in euros rather than dollars. And in the last several For the Record broadcasts, I've been detailing the Franco-German opposition to American military action in Iraq, and also German support for elements as diverse as Saddam Hussein and for EU/German support for the PLO in terms of a geopolitical struggle. And to make a very, very long story very, very short, the only reason the United States has gotten away with the deficit spending that it escaped reckoning for in the 1980s and that had basically gotten behind it, courtesy of Bill Clinton, was by borrowing against the dollar status as a reserve currency abroad. It was borrowing against those dollars held as reserve currency. As the euro makes its inroads into the dollar's province as a reserve currency, that is going to put the United States in very bad shape indeed. Now, what we're going to be looking at for much of the rest of the broadcast is the career and positioning of a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. Otto von Bolschwing was Adolf Eichmann's superior for a period of time in the SS and charged with overseeing, quote, Jewish matters, unquote. And beyond that, Otto von Bolschwing was an intelligence officer and was brought to the United States by Alan Dulles as part of the Crusade for Freedom, this importation of Nazi war criminals and Central and Eastern European fascist collaborators that ultimately coalesced into the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, an institution which sometime in the 1980s and 90s began to incorporate Islamic extremist elements, including Wahhabi / Muslim Brotherhood / Al-Qaeda / Al-Taqwa elements, as we looked at in For the Records 356, 357, and 382, among other shows. Otto von Bolschwing was again brought to the United States as part of the Crusade for Freedom. He was brought by specifically Alan Dulles, and one of Otto von Bolschwing's protégés was a woman named Helena von Damm. And Helena von Damm married a member of the same military intelligence unit as William Clark, Ronald Reagan's second national security advisor. That's a very common methodology, by the way, for moving an intelligence operative across borders. You have the Marion national of the country to which they're going to move, and then they get a divorce. That happened with Helena von Damm. Helena von Damm was not only a professional associate of Otto von Bolschwing's, she was his protege and was allegedly implicated in some of the Iran-Contra activities as well. In For the Record 332, as well as in RFA number 30, we took a look at Helena von Damm and RFA number 3s. We took a look at Helena von Damm's pivotal role in the Reagan administrations. Basically, she picked the list of all of the selections from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments. And Helena von Damm was a protege of Otto von Bolschwing. Now, the author of this column, George Bisharat, is quite accurate in seeing links between some of the most hawkish elements of the second Bush administration, all of them, by the way, veterans of the Reagan administration, and picked by Helena von Damm, protege of Otto von Bolschwing. The nominal relationship cited by George Bisharat is quite accurate, but the portraying of this administration as being the tool of a Zionist conspiracy couldn't be farther from the truth. But in examining Otto von Bolschwing's manipulation of the whole question of Zionism in the pre-World War II and early World War II periods, I think we can see a perhaps foreshadowing of the way in which Israel and Zionism is being strategically manipulated today. My feeling is that if there is a conflict in the Middle East that spreads beyond the Middle East, it may very well involve, ultimately, the wiping out of Israel. Again, the let's you and him fight scenario that I've advanced in the past, the wiping out of Israel, the destruction of the United States, and the collapse of the world economy, which would then be blamed on the international Zionist conspiracy and of the Zionist control of the United States. In this context, the Underground Reich's manipulation of the Israeli right, their probable sabotage of the peace talks in 2000, and the scenario I'm about to read to you should be equated. And I would suggest that when Otto von Bolschwing protege Helena von Damm drew up these right-wing Jews, many of whom have now been dubbed the neoconservatives, including people like Benjamin Netanyahu's associates, Netanyahu himself, with strong links to the fascist element within the Zionist movement, that basically Jews in general, Israelis and Zionists in particular, were being set up as the geopolitical scapegoat for a worldwide conflagration, which would then be used to as the pretext for the Nazi takeover. And it would be blamed on the Jews. We're going to read now from The Secret War Against the Jews, How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. John Loftus, a former career military officer and a government investigator with a very high security clearance. And he describes Alan Dulles, King Ibn Saud, who along with Otto von Bolschwing, King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, one of whose close friends, of course, was Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and Jack Philby, a British spy who was actually a Nazi double agent, conspiring, again, Ibn Saud, Jack Philby, and Otto von Bolschwing conspired in order to drum up British support and Zionist support for widespread emigration of Jews to Palestine, not for the purposes of setting up a Jewish state, but in order to alienate. In this case, the Zionist movement was being used in effect as sort of an agent provocateur entity to inflame the Arab population against Britain. And in the context of what we're looking at today, I think this same scenario may have been the paradigm for what we're seeing on a worldwide basis, basically scapegoating the Jews for what is intended to be a devastating attack, not only on the United States, but ultimately wiping out Israel and causing a worldwide economic collapse and social chaos into which the Underground Reich would move in a controlling way. We're going to look at von Bolschwing's conspiring with Ibn Saud in the passage that follows. Eichmann was replaced on the Middle Eastern scene by a far more skilled intelligence officer, Otto von Bolschwing. Before World War II, von Bolschwing set up an import-export business in Palestine as a cover for his espionage initiatives. He was an educated man from a good family and an enthusiastic supporter of Hitler. After the war, von Bolschwing became one of Alan Dulles' senior agents in the CIA. Dulles helped von Bolschwing emigrate to California, where he established a business association with Helena von Damm, later Ronald Reagan's ambassador to Austria. In later years, his business went bankrupt, and he was forced to surrender his American citizenship on the grounds that he was a Nazi war criminal. He was just the sort of fellow to get along well with Jack Philby. He hated Jews. In the 1930s, Otto von Bolschwing was a realist. He knew full well that Muslim bigots would never accept even a token immigration of Jews to Palestine. Philby agreed. After more than a decade of anti-Zionist propaganda, quietly supervised by the British Secret Service, the climate was hardly receptive toward a homeland for the Jews in the Middle East. Still, there was profit to be made in the attempt. In any future war, von Bolschwing said, the support of the Muslim world was essential to Hitler's plans. Not to mention that Philby and Ibn Saud could make a healthy profit by secretly ensuring Germany's supply of oil. Hitler would guarantee that the Muslims received favored status. Indeed, they later had their own SS division, raised ironically from among the Bosnian Muslim population subjected to ethnic cleansing by the Serbs and Croats 50 years later. The SS division was personally blessed by Philby's old friend, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. The Mufti had been Hitler's honored guest and was even taken on guided tours of the Nazi death camps. Hitler promised that when Germany won the war, he would guarantee that the Arab states would be free of British colonial domination. They would be independent states and full allies with the Third Reich. All of Philby's dreams could come to pass. All that was needed was a little push. Von Bolschwing's proposition was simple. Philby should encourage British support for Zionist emigration schemes, penetrate the secret negotiations, and then leak them to the press with the certain knowledge that the popular discontent with the certain knowledge of the popular discontent that would result among Muslims. The Arab backlash to a new British Zionist initiative might not drive the region into the arms of the Third Reich, but it would certainly keep the oil-producing Arabs, quote, neutral, unquote, but actually tilting toward the Nazis. It was no secret that Ibn Saud had more than little sympathy for the German position on the Zionist issue. His extreme anti-Jewish feelings were made clear to a British diplomat in 1937. The king said his, quote, hatred for the Jews, unquote, stemmed from, quote, their persecution and rejection, unquote, of Christ, and that, quote, their subsequent rejection of Muhammad. Ibn Saud added that, quote, for a Muslim to kill a Jew in war or for him to be killed by a Jew ensures him an immediate entry into heaven and into the august presence of God Almighty, very much like the way the September 11th conspirators saw their situation. Continuing, according to several of our sources, this was one of the aspects of Islam that most appealed to Philby. He had all sorts of schemes that could aid the Nazis, who meant business when it came to the Jews. Our sources say Jack obtained the king's permission to become a double agent for the Third Reich, publicly helping the Jews, privately aiding the Nazis, always making a profit for the House of Saud and, naturally, himself. The scheme appealed to Philby's clandestine nature. The more he worked to link Britain and Zionism publicly, the more damage he could do to the empire's position in the Middle East. And again, bearing in mind von Bolschwing protege Helena von Damm's links to the administration that appointed these right-wing Likud Party Jews to a key position, and they've now moved up in the second Bush administration. I think using Jews and Zionists and Israel as agent provocateur, this time to manipulate anti-American sentiment and ultimately into underground Reich control of the Earth Island. I think that's the scenario that we're looking at here. Skipping down in the book. In fact, the king and Jack were playing a nasty little game with the Jews. Despite their, quote, disagreement over the partition plan, in early 1939, Ibn Saud sent Philby to London to be on hand for the Palestine Roundtable Conference. It does seem rather strange that the king would send someone whose views conflicted so clearly with his own. Apparently, Philby's true mission was sabotage. In order to set all sides against each other, Philby developed his own plan on the Palestine question, which he put to British officials as well as to the Jews and Arabs. In February 1939, he had a secret lunch with Weizmann and Ben-Gurion and introduced the Zionist leaders to Fuad Hamza, Ibn Saud's longtime foreign affairs official. Philby offered the Zionists substantial Jewish immigration into Palestine if they would support the country coming under Saudi domination. Weizmann was blamed when the, quote, secret, unquote, plan was leaked to the press, and there was no further progress. As will be seen, all of Philby's schemes with the Zionists had a suspicious habit of coming to nothing. There is a definite pattern of sabotage with the Zionists as, quote, fall guys, unquote, every time. And bear in mind that his partner in this episode was Otto von Bolschwing, whose protege Helena von Damm brought the neocons into the first Reagan administration. They have now moved up into the second Bush administration. This concludes For the Record program number 399, side 2, The Serpent's Diaries, being recorded on February 16th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.